Deuteronomy 6, starting at verse 1. Love the Lord your God. These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live, by keeping all his decrees and commands that I give you, and so that you may enjoy long life. Hear, Israel, and be careful to obey, so that it may go well with you, and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised you. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands, and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. We thank God for his word.
Well, good morning. It's good to be with you this morning. I bring you greetings from Guildford. Sunny Guildford when I left, sunny Harper when I arrived. That's always got to be good. Homes are funny places to be Christians. I am a professional Christian. When I go home, I like to switch off from those demands and relax a little bit, but of course I can't do that. I kind of married into a Christian home, and what I mean by that is I didn't grow up in a Christian home. And so I didn't go to Sunday school, and we didn't do family prayers, or about the only thing I can vaguely remember growing up as a kid, we had an old family Bible and in the bookshelves, and every now and again, I went through this little phase in my teenage years where I'd go and seek the Bible out, and for some reason I discovered the Gospels, and for some reason in the Gospels I discovered the passion story, the story of Christ's crucifixion. And I was drawn to that. And every now and again, I can remember just reading this and being disturbed by it. Not having a clue what it meant, but anyway. Whereas my wife, Lindsay, did grow up in a Christian home. And so when we got married and had children, there was this kind of, how are we going to bring up our children in a Christian home? What does it mean for that? When my eldest daughter was baptized, her opening line was, I grew up in a kind of Christian home. Which got everyone a laugh as she said that at her baptism. But what do you do? Grace at every meal? Grace at breakfast? Anybody? Oh, no, I'm not going to do show of hands things. Grace at breakfast? Grace at main meal? If it's a sandwich, do you say grace or don't you? Is it just main meals? What if it's a TV dinner? Do you say grace at TV dinner or not? Grace holding hands? Grace not holding hands? When you go and visit other people's homes, are they hand holders or not hand holders? How's this going to go? Are we going to feel relaxed or not relaxed? My eldest daughter's boyfriend, first time he came around for a meal, we're not handholders. I think we used to be handholders, but we've stopped that now. And discovered one of the children wasn't washing frequently enough. So, and anyway, so Steph came to join us for the first time for a meal with my eldest daughter, and she was 19, 20, he came to join us for a meal. And I said, right, let's hold hands and say the grace together. Which, of course, he had no idea whether we were handholders or not. And I was sat next to him, so of course he grabs my hand. The expression on my children's faces and the look of horror upon them, how I played this prank on Steph's first meal with us, was horrific. So, what about family prayer times? You know, in the evening meal, after the evening meal, some people read Bible, some people don't. Before bedtime, read the Bible, don't you read the Bible? It's very hard at times to be Christian, to understand what Christian means at home. And one of the great dangers I would suggest is that we've, dare I say, palmed off a lot of the responsibility for the nurturing and teaching of children in the faith to fantastic youth leaders and youth groups and Sunday school teams and things like that. And the statistics about young people dropping out of church life when they get to their mid-teens is terrifying. And we wonder what that's all about, and immediately we want to look into the youth work and what we can do with the youth work and how can we change the youth work. And I think there's a bunch of youth leaders who would say, well, what about the homes as well? What can we do to support the homes and the places where these children are growing up into? Because if there's an inconsistency between what's happening in so-called church world and what's happening in home world, that can be problematic and tricky. A lot of parents get home and they're just too tired to talk and to answer the questions, and they just need to relax. And single people, it can be really challenging. On the one hand, everyone says, we've got all that time, you've got all that freedom. What a great place, it's a mission base, your home, all to yourself. How can you use that for yourself? And that's fine, and some single people are able to embrace that, and their homes become amazing places. People can flow in and out and receive hospitality and prayer and support. And for other single people who are desperately battling with a deep sense of loneliness, and often forgottenness, the challenges are very, very different in terms of what does it mean for me at home to be a Christian? What would it look like? I'm on my own, nobody can see. And what patterns do I have? I have no one to hold hands and say grace with. And they tell me that Jesus is here, but sometimes it, quite frankly, doesn't feel that way. And with homes and families that are now more complex and diverse than ever before, and divorce and remarriage and stepchildren, and can you be there and can you be here, and Christians and non-Christian marrying, and if I'm the Christian, can I tithe my income because my husband or my wife will struggle with that, and do I go to church every Sunday or every other Sunday, or how does this all work? But we might truly be the people of God wherever we find ourselves. And that passage that we've just heard read. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and all your strength, so that it might go well with you. The Lord might bless you, that you might live well in the land, that you would know prosperity and security, you would know the presence of God. But this is where it begins. Hear, O church. The Lord is one. There is no other God. There is no other Lord and creator of all things. There is no other option. There is no other possibility for those of us for whom this is our confession. The Lord is one. The Lord alone is God. Sometimes I get the train and go up to Waterloo Station, that's the Guildford Mainline Station Inn. And you know those images when you get off a train and all the doors open up and all this mass of humanity spills out onto the platform, and you wonder how many even will give it a thought today, where they have come from, why they are here, and where they are going. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. The Lord alone is God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is at the heart of the commandments we are called to carry. Love God. So Jesus, when he was asked, what's the greatest commandment? It hasn't changed. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength, and love your neighbour as yourself. After that, you can do what you like. As long as whatever you do is an expression of love to God, or an expression of love to your neighbour. The difficulty that we have in our consumer-orientated world and in the nervousness in our homes of driving our young people away by being overzealous and over the top and weird and quirky and embarrassing and awkward, but still we are held by this one great cry over us as God's people. Love the Lord your God because he alone is God. There is no hope for our children or for our children's children unless they too might come to believe that he alone is God. And so, the wisdom of Solomon, we seek to hold these things together because that we know for the generations that come after us, their security, their identity, their humanity, their peace as ordinary people exists in this one great truth. The God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who first raised Israel out of Egypt and then raised Jesus Christ from the dead, he alone is God. Worship him, serve him, obey him, love him. Be loyal to him, honor him. With all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. It's what it means for us to be a community of God's people. It's what sets us apart from every other group that we'll meet this week in Hartford or Guildford. I grew up in a little town called Bungay in Suffolk. Weird things go on there. But there's still little clusters of people who own the name of God and seek to be faithful to him in a complex, hostile, challenging world. But teach it, says the Bible. Teach it to your children and to your children's children. Because in this and this alone is life and possibility and hope. But how, we cry. You see, the problem is, and why we have to teach it, is the greatest threat to the people of God, to the community of God, is not a threat from outside, but is simply that we might forget who we are. That is at the heart of this passage. It's not good enough. We taught our children once, 10 years ago, Jesus is Lord, trust him, everything will be fine, tick the box and move on and do what we like. The passage says, teach it everywhere you go. Walking, talking, sitting, sleeping, waking, round meal tables, round the telly, over hobbies, while doing your homework, while trying to watch the television and this child's rabbit in your ear, got a question. You see, the greatest threat to us as the people of God is not the threats from outside, it's simply that we might forget to tell our children who we are. And that they then might forget to tell their children who we are and who is our God and how we find our identity and how we are held together with this great truth. And how you do that, I don't know your circumstances. I don't know your personality. I don't know who you live with and where they're at in their journey, except that this truth tells us that everywhere is sacred and every possibility is an opportunity and every moment is filled with the potential. But God is there. Elizabeth Barrett Browning said this, and I'll read it to get it right. Earth crammed with heaven and every bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries. That as we stroll down the high street, we see with the eyes of the Spirit, and we see the presence of God, and we are attentive to moments where we can teach, and we can share, and we can be truly Christian. Everywhere, once again, is sacred. Every moment, every TV program, every mealtime, every bedtime, every waking, every bored child bouncing off the walls moment. Jesus is there. Jesus is there. And so we are called to imagine, to use our creativity and imagination. I don't know what works for you. I know what works for other families, that wouldn't work for us. What works for us wouldn't work for other families.
But we are called to use our imaginations and to be creative and to look for possibilities and to allow our children to grow up in a Christian home, to allow ourselves to go home to a Christian home where God is at the heart of all that happens in that place. Everything is sacred. We can imagine every possibility. That we might communicate, that we might be truly the people of God. The danger, however, is that sometimes there can be a disconnect between the words we say and the actions that we keep. And it's not just that we might forget to say who we are, but we might forget to be who we are. And that some of the most powerful teaching moments that have challenged you, have inspired you, or upset you, have not involved words at all, but a look or a glance, a reaction. That's not Christian. We say to our children, they say, I know Jesus says that he loves everybody, but you're not bringing him home. We're not having him in our doors, not with all those bits of metal stuck in their ears and that weird outfit that they're wearing. They could clean themselves up a bit, polish up their language, but they're not coming into our home. And we wonder what that means. And we wonder what that says. That in the queue at the checkout, and the person in the till clearly hasn't got a clue what they are doing, that we might be Christian in front of those who watch us. That in the frustrations of that phone call with that double glazing salesman again, our child is there. What are we going to do? How are we going to sound? How are we going to be? To take responsibility, one with each other, that we might nurture homes of Christian faith. That the flow of life that flows in and out of church, from home into church and church into home, might be a seamless stream, might be a seamless flow of people who see God everywhere and in everything, who know but for the generations to come, we must be truly faithful in everything that we do. We must persist in our faithfulness, trusting that only through our obedience will the next generation ever begin to understand what it looks like and what it sounds like. But for some of us who feel our days are coming to an end, that we have served the church faithfully and our responsibilities, our gift to the church is now over. We appeal to you, please. You are the ones who hold our children. You are the ones our children and our grandchildren look to. You have run the race. You have held the course. You are faithful even in your later years. Let them watch you grow old, full of grace and truth, so that we might watch you die, full of faith and peace, ready to meet the one that you have served all of your days. persist in our faithfulness, to persist in our obedience, even when the prodigals are all but a distant memory to most of us around, that one day they may come home. That the seed sown in faith and in tears in those early years may hold them. Because the most glorious truth of this passage is that it is God who holds his people. It is not the people who hold God. It is not our responsibility to keep the promises. It's the promises that keep us. And even in those frustrating and dark times, there is still a God who goes where we go, who lives where we live, and follows our children and our children wherever they are. And they are never out of his sight or out of his memory. Because it was God who constitutes the church. It is God who gathers the church. It is God who holds the church. In our fragile and failing faith, in our sinful and at times disappointing lives, the grace of God that lifts us and forgives us and calls us and cleanses us flows once again in our front room, in our back room, in our upstairs bedroom, in the back kitchen, in our gardens, our driveways, wherever we might be. Hear, O Israel. Believe this. Hear it. The Lord is God. The Lord is one. The Lord alone. And in the light of his grace and his mercy, love him. Love him. Love him. Serve him. Trust him. Put one step in front of the other, one faithful act of kindness after the other, with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And he will bless you. And he will hold you and your children and your children's children. Amen.